Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 204 on investing in hotels with Mike Stoller. If you're into building wealth through real estate investing, you are in the right place. My goal is to identify high-caliber real estate investors and other industry service providers, invite them on the show, and then draw out the jewels of wisdom, those tactics, mindsets, and methods used to create millions of dollars or more in the business of real estate. Today's guest, Mike Stoller, is a former commercial airline pilot, Navy veteran, and co-founder at Gateway Private Equity Group. Including apartment complexes, houses, and hotels, Mike has owned or operated over 1,300 units. Seeking value-add opportunities and higher returns, Mike then pivoted from multifamily to hotels and now focuses exclusively in this niche. Investing in hotels is really a twofold investment. First, you're investing in the real estate where the hotel is located. Second, and maybe more importantly, you're investing in the business that is running that hotel successfully. Because of this dual nature, hotel investing can be riskier than other real estate investments, but at the same time offer larger and faster returns when executed properly. Ready to begin? All right, welcome to the REI Diamond Show. Mike, how are you doing today?
Doing well, thank you, Dan.
Nice. So location stamp, I'm in Chicago recording live. Whereabouts are you? Maybe what markets you also focus on, if any?
Yeah, I'm in Scottsdale, Arizona. I'm loving life. It's finally under 100 degrees. We're in fall. And I do mainly Arizona. We do some things Midwest and then the Southeast.
All right. So to give some background, maybe you just want to start about the evolution of your real estate career mm-hmm. and what your business looks like today.
Sure. Yeah. I'll try to keep it quick. I got started. I'm a little bit older. I got started. I call it the PG days, the pre-Google days, and absolutely failed. You know, I did probably what a lot of you did is I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, got excited, bought some tickets to seminar land, and then bam, okay, I'm in small town Indiana at the time. Buying was the easy part. And then I didn't know how to be a landlord. I'm like, okay, wait, there's paperwork. What's a lease? Get out. You know, so I need a 5-day notice. You know, I didn't know anything, right? And I couldn't Google anything. So I failed. I mean, and failed miserably. Just because I just didn't know what to do. We don't have podcasts. We don't have mentoring. We didn't have any of that back in the days. If I needed a tenant, it's like, what do I do? Put an ad in the newspaper, you know, and it's the old day of doing things, old way. Fast forward, you know, what I did is I learned. I was like, man, you know, this is the way that I need to do it. This is how you make money. Real estate is it. So I actually went to work for a property management group because I was like, you know, that's the part, the buying was the easy part, but how do I get experience? How do I get a mentor? So I actually went and worked for them and I learned that end of it. I learned how to be a landlord because there's two parts of it, right? You're an investor, but then once you get the asset, how do you become the landlord that someone wants to, you know, stay in your asset. So you have to learn both sides of it. So that's what I did. And then I started in about 10 years later, you know, this is probably during the recession time period, I started getting back into it because I was like going, okay, there's going to be some deals. I now have money. I have some cash. I have a good job. Let's get back into it. And I basically fast forward. I went from a fourplex to two hotels, you know, to 20 homes. I own managed around 1,300 units of multifamily. And I did that within about a 7-8 year time period.
Nice.
I just went overboard, you know, just went, okay, now I've got the experience because now in my investment 2.0, I had confidence, right? I knew what I was doing.
So I read in your profile that you were a Navy pilot, was it? And then a commercial airline pilot too, Mike?
Well, I was Navy.
Okay.
This didn't allow me to be the Navy pilot.
Okay.
But I wanted to be the Navy pilot. Well, you know, I watched Top Gun when I was little. I'm like, oh, you know, I got the ninja part down, you know, riding the motorcycle, but they wouldn't let me in. So went into the Navy, served in the first Gulf War. And then after the failure of, you know, all that, the first time period, my dream was to become an airline pilot. So I did stick with the pilot, became an airline pilot. And that was what allowed me to have the money to get back into the real estate investing.
Nice. Thank you for your service, Mike.
Thank you very much.
I'm curious with that lead in there for being a pilot. So every time I fly, I'm doing these risk versus reward calculations, right? It's like, yeah, we're 30,000 feet up. I've flown, you know, small planes with a co-pilot who did all the work. And I was toying with the idea of getting my license, but I think we turned the engines off during that training and we'll just, you know, feel the flight. Silent flight to the ground. So I feel like there's this risk calculation that must, I hope this risk calculation is going through the minds of the pilot that I'm in the plane flying, right? And I'm wondering, do you have a certain view toward risk? Is there anything from flying a commercial airline that suddenly makes you view the risk in a different fashion than someone whose feet has always been on the ground when it comes to real estate investing?
Yes. You know, that is, man, I'm getting chills with that question. That is one of the best questions I've been asked in a long, long time. And I'll take it one step further. It's also the military part.
Okay.
And the airline pilot part. In both of those, in all three, the risk assessment. Now, you know, in the military and airlines, it's more of a life and death type thing, you know?
Yeah.
But in doing that, yes, it's, nothing is emotional in the military and in the airlines. If there's an emergency situation, if there's any type of situation that I'm looking at, I don't look at anything emotionally. It's a checklist. It's a risk analysis. You're just going through bullet points. And you have to understand that the amount of training that we do in the military and the amount of training that we do as an airline pilot, you know, as an airline pilot, they don't put me in a live sim to see how I fly. They all know that we have thousands of hours. They actually put us in and try to kill us. They do. They put us in those situations over and over and over and over again to where if we ever get that in the real life situation, you're just, you know, clicking buttons and you're just going through the checklist. And, you know, if you ever watch, you know, the Hudson River thing, how calm his voice was, because he's just like going, hey, yep, we got to go. And, you know, yep, we're doing this. And that's the way that we do things. You translate that into the real estate. And again, I look at things non-emotional. I go through my checklist. I don't care how great this asset looks, where it's at. If it doesn't cash flow, if it doesn't do what I intend it to do, I'm not going to buy it. You know, I don't care. You just, when you get into real estate investing, it's non-emotional. And that's what I learned from taking with those two things and coming into real estate is I go through my checklist. And especially with the hotels, you know, if 8 of the 10 things are checkmarked, but maybe 2 or 3 aren't, I'm not going to do it. And you have to stick to that checklist or else you're going to get bit.
So hotels are like a first on this show, and it's an interesting topic. And we've all stayed in hotels, just like most of us have probably been on commercial airlines, and we're happy that someone is up front who's been through this endless number of scenarios to accommodate for any of the risk that we all have when we're in the air. I think a lot of people, probably even myself and maybe you, Mike, have blindly taken on too much risk early in our careers with real estate, right? It's like, we buy this house because it's near our house. We can drive by, self-manage it. I've lived in a house, so therefore I know houses. I've rented a house, therefore I know tenants. And blindly taking on risk we just weren't aware of. But I'm curious. So we've all stayed in hotels, right? And I was just literally thinking this over the weekend as I was in a hotel out in Seattle. Who owns this? What are the economics? What are the risks? I mean, hotels are everywhere. They can't all be owned by the REITs in these public situations. Right. In fact, I get the auctions for hotels on my mailing list, and I've been eyeing them up as an asset class personally. Little hotels that are probably 2 or 3 story walk up. Maybe there's a small elevator in there. They're probably, you know, Motel 6 style. I think I saw a Hilton come through in the $4 or $5 million range right around COVID. And I'm wondering, like, what are the economics? What are the risks? But before we get into kind of talking about the parameters of deals that you've done, maybe you could talk about the transition. Like, how did you find the first hotel deal and decide that this makes sense and I'm going to move forward? What was that path like?
You know, the path was, you know, I'd gotten all these, this multifamily, and I finally, I had this person in here in Phoenix area in the Valley. It's the real estate market for the last 5 or 6 years. It's nuts. It's crazy. And I had blindly, this person wanted to buy one of my complexes, and I didn't want to, it just made too much money. And they kept coming and coming and coming and coming. I'm thinking, just like, man, these people are like from Idaho or somewhere, you know, just blindly calling me. Well, it finally got to the point where I was like, I'm a fool if I don't sell this thing, because you know, I had this asset for 10 months and I made $860,000.
Wow.
Off this complex. And I was like, I've got to sell it. I mean, it's like, I can't not do this. But then I was like, oh, now what am I going to do? You know, it's, I didn't want to pay the tax. You know, I was going 1031, but then I was like, oh man, you know, am I going to now buy something at a 4 cap or, you know, something like that. So as you real estate investors know, it's about networking. You network, you know, whatever your meetups, your real estate investment groups, always get to know, always go out to the meetings and meet and greet, you know, anybody and everybody. And one of these guys is just kind of in the back of my mind had about 15 years of hotel investment. I'm like, going, oh, hotels, kind of the same as like everyone else, you know. But then I was like, I remember him telling me that they're still like a 9 cap, 10 cap, you know, they're really doing well. And, you know, and commercials, we don't really look at cap rates like that. You know, we do more of a gross income multiplier type of the thing. But he was telling me that there's just really some great opportunities in there because not a lot of people are in the hotel space. Well, what I did was I reached out to him. I said, hey, you know what? I want to get into the hotel space, but I know zero about it. I have the money. Can you find me a hotel? And I want you to run it for me. You know, I just threw it out there, you know, because I'm not going to run it. I don't even know how. And that's what he does. I mean, he has all this experience. And he goes, and I said, you know, I'll give you a little property management fee. But here's the kicker. I said, if you teach me everything you know, if I go through day one on through, I will actually give you a piece at the back end. I'll actually give him a percentage of ownership that when we sell it or if we sell it, he actually gets that. So that's where his, so now I have someone that's running the operations that has an invested interest, because the better that he does it and we ended up, you know, if we ended up selling it, he actually gets something for it without putting any money in.
Is that percentage something you're allowed or feel comfortable sharing with us?
Yeah, I am actually giving him, depending on the parameters, and it's a lot, but it was well worth it. Because with property management groups, you know, there's no vested interest. If you have a property management group in hotels, they don't care. They're just paying bills. They're just doing this, and they're not looking at it because they don't have any ownership. So I actually, on this first deal, I actually gave him 20% of my deal. And, you know, that's, it's a lot. But if you look at what it's allowed me to do, and knowing how much I would have paid that 20% in seminars and learning and mistakes, I would rather pay that much money to learn the right way instead of paying that kind of money in seminar land and all these other things, and maybe not have even bought a hotel yet.
Yeah, it probably doesn't even exist, right? Like, how many seminar invites do I get for the hotel industry?
Right,
like,
right. Well, maybe that's my next.
That's your niche.
My next niche, you know, do hotel seminars.
Is there a performance metric tied to that ownership? Hey, you have to hit this benchmark. We need these kind of values, and then that triggers, or?
Well, it's not like a performance benchmark, but what it is. He has to stay on as the operations group. And the performance benchmark is I get all of my down payment plus a percentage upfront, you know, the first thing. So there's
like
not a lot of
return.
That's like a preferred return I get.
Okay.
Plus all of my down payment. And so all of my costs are all automatically returned back to me plus a preferred. And then it's okay, you know, if we sell it for $6 million, there's not a lot there. If we sell it for $8 million, there's a lot there. You know, if we sell for $10 million, there's a lot there. So it's basically you're doing a lot of work for 4, 5, 6 years, 7 years for that amount of money. Or if you want a lot of money, then he has, it's like, okay, let's do it. You know, and it's, it's right now valued around $3.5 million more than we bought it for. So it's working, you know, it's doing its job and he's doing his job.
So can we talk parameters on that deal? Like, how long ago did you buy it? Maybe what was the, I don't know, the cash flow, the gross income multiply. What were kind of the parameters of the deal? What made it attractive? Why did you think that the operations and the cash flow could be increased? I mean, what was your mindset and when was the purchase? And let's dive into that beginning of that deal.
Sure. This purchase was in, the first one was in 2017. And a couple of things that we liked. It was an absentee owner, which is always a plus. It was in a smaller town outside of the Phoenix metro area that we saw was, there's going to be a lot of growth. There's going to be a lot of things. There was already some things that were planned. The current management general manager, it was being managed not properly. We saw a lot of this guy with 15 years experience, saw a lot of missteps, a lot of things that could immediately be fixed. The guy had just converted it from one flag, which is a franchise, to another. And he was seeing some decrease revenues because of the change of the we call it the flag. It was, when we look at things on how, where to put hotels and where to buy hotels, we look at what's called drivers. Drivers are what drives people to stay at your hotel. Why did you stay at that specific hotel on the West Coast? You know, there's a reason you picked these areas. Number one, we picked this one because it was the only one in the town that had truck driver parking. Now, this is a limited service hotel. Limited service hotel means you get your free breakfast, your free Wi-Fi, and then you leave. Okay. It's just your basic, like what you were saying, you know, couple story, a lobby, an elevator, you know, it's just one of these simple hotels, which we love. Only one with truck driver parking. It was off of, it's off of a major highway. which we like, but it's not inside the metro area of Phoenix, which we like. It was right across the street from a hospital, so that's another driver that people will have. That's another thing. You know, they're coming to visit people at the hospital. They're going to stay at our hotel because we're the one that's right across the street. So that's another thing that they're going to have. Another driver was all the construction that's going on. There's a big electric car company that came in and built this huge fab. So because there was all these different drivers and it was a fairly good sized hotel, for the price, we said, okay, you know, we're going to do it because we know that there's a lot of potential for growth. And with those drivers, that's why we did it.
Gotcha. So what kind of money was being made on the purchase price? Was it a cap rate, something we would kind of be able to understand and relate to in real estate investor economics as opposed to hotel economics?
Yeah. So what we do is on gross income, you know, really quickly, you know, where it's at, what type of hotel, everything in areas are based on gross multipliers. If you go buy a different business, you don't say that, well, I'm going to buy a textile company, what's the cap rate? You don't do that. It's usually, well, it sells for 2x gross or 2.5x gross. That's how you do it. And that's the difference between multifamily and hotels is hotels are considered a business.
Okay.
That sits on real estate. Okay. Multifamily is just real estate. So you can go cap rates and you can do IRRs and all that sort of stuff. Cash on cash. The hotels we look at, you know, if it's worth 3.5x the gross, let's try to get it for 3x. So it's kind of like the same play with cap rates, NOIs and things like that. And then we looked at what we thought it could do. We thought it could do, 1.4, 1.5 million gross. It was only doing about right around a million. And he was doing like 1.4, 1.5 with it being a Best Western, but because he changed it, it really sunk. Well, just like in multifamily, you know, he was trying to sell it on pro forma, right? Well, it's going to do this. And I'm like going, well, COVID could happen.
Yeah, right. You know, who'd have saw that coming?
Who'd have saw that coming? We buy things on actuals. So he grumbled. And so we were able to get it for a lot more. It is now doing, it only lost about 10% during COVID. So it did really, really, really well. And it's going to do probably 1.9 to, we're maybe hoping 2 million by the end of the year.
Nice.
So we've expanded it. And the way that things work in the hotel and in commercial industry is, as you go up $100,000 increments, then you have that translates into a higher gross than a higher price, you know, as far as what it would appraise for and that you can sell it for. So as you go up in that revenue, that's how you can go from, you know, a $5 million purchase to an $8 to $10 million purchase, you know, or selling price.
Do you guys fly, if any, right? Because I'm going through my mind, I'm like, yeah, I'd rather stay at a Best Western than something whose like name was just picked from the local area, right? It's kind of like,
yeah, Dan and Mike's Hotel or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, like now I'm gonna tell you, I'd keep driving,
or you know, the sign says, you know, pay by the hour or something like that, sleep or the here. Day, right? Yeah, sleep here. Yeah, so this one is a Choice branded. That one is
okay.
We have some Radissons. I like the either the what did really well in COVID, it kind of like completely changed my attitude of what we're going to buy is that limited service hotel, the no frills. I call it the blue collar hotels. And, you know, I mean, those are some other questions about, you know, how we survived COVID and things like that and what I learned about COVID. But
yeah, why don't you riff on that a bit? COVID happened. Yeah. I'm sure everyone's like, wow, I would have hated to buy a hotel in 2017 and then be hit by COVID. But a 10% dip sounds reasonably survivable, yeah, if not even good thing coming through COVID, right?
It did. So, you know, that one. So here's what I learned. Everyone has, even in the multifamily world, all these investors, all of us have this aspiration of, I'm going to buy this big, bad, cool, you know, I always had this dream. I'm going to buy this hotel that I'm going to sit in the bar in my hotel, have a scotch, you know, and look around, you know, at all the coolness, right? Well, who was the first ones that closed down during COVID or all the cool hotels? The reason being is if you have a lot of restaurants, a lot of conference spaces, you have a lot of overhead, you have a lot of rooms, you're in like a downtown area or this, you know, kicking place, you couldn't survive because your business is around people coming in for happy hours, people coming in for businesses. What survived that one down in that small town outside of that metro area? Who was the lifeblood of our existence during COVID? That was the truck drivers. That was the first responders. Going along the highways, people didn't want to stay in the big cities because of COVID. They wanted to stay in the small towns just outside. I can still sleep in a, and plus, you know, in the small town, that same exact hotel's maybe $20, $25 cheaper a night just because it's not in the big city. So that changed my attitude of like, okay, this hotel only lost 10% because we had all these people still coming in. Truck drivers still needed a place to sleep. When the nurses and doctors couldn't go home from that hospital because of COVID, because they didn't want to, you know, maybe infect their children and their family, they stayed at our hotel. It's like, okay, it's kind of changing. I don't want this flashy thing because I'm not saying if, you know, probably when COVID 2.0 and 3.0 or things happen down the line in years to come, that type of hotel and those specific type of drivers are very important. Another one that really did well is like the extended stays, because maybe the nurses and the doctors and things like that, they say, well, you know, let me stay an extended stay for a month. And so those really did well. The ones that we have that didn't do that well still stayed open, but were the ones that I thought were just going to rock. They're the ones that were in the business park, that were in the tech centers, you know, the Radisson, the brand new stuff that is just, man, this is going to be great. You know, I'm 2 miles from all these big companies. And well, when no one was traveling, no one was showing up, you know, those suffered. So we had to kind of switch gears a little bit on how we marketed those hotels.
So how did you find that first deal? Was that something in your partner's network that he had found? It was just for sale and then lingering on the market? I mean, what constituted your ability to get that deal done early on?
Yeah, it was, had been on the market and then fell off because, you know, the guy just wanted too much money. And nobody was really analyzing it, I think, properly when they're looking at, you know, you can go into a house and you look at it and it's like, oh my God, this is the ugliest house. But, you know, if you look beyond that and say, well, you know, if we take this wall down and we rehab it, it could be a very cool place. And that's what we were kind of looking at. And the guy, the operations partner that I have, he just knows all the different brokers that know the areas that could really give us an idea of of what that market was like and that type of hotel. And they're the ones that said, yeah, we went to the chamber and it's like, okay, what's coming in the pipeline? What are some of the things? So with all that research that we did, and we reached down to some of the actual business people in the community down there and said, what do you see? You know, I noticed that you opened up another little grocery store. Why did you do that? And so we looked at who was growing down there and asked them, it's like, why are you growing? And they gave us some really good feedback, and luckily the banks looked at it and praised it. And what's another thing about the SBA or the hotels that are great is we're able to do SBA loans because it's a business, and that's another reason why we survived COVID is because we're a business. We got all the PPP, to keep our employees involved in the hotel. We got the EIDLs. My biggest job for the last year was to look at for every grant possible, and we were able to get those where a lot of the multifamily people and they're not able to do those things because these are small business grants, keeping small business owners open. You heard all that in the last year and a half about keeping local businesses open. And that's something we were able to do.
So what are the returns for, the return structure, the profit, I guess, however you look at your own return as the operator, mm-hmm. as one question. And then mm-hmm. a second question would be if somebody were to passively invest in your next hotel deal, what would the returns look like for that person?
Yeah, well, I'm doing air quotes on possible returns because we don't know, how long COVID and things, just things are going to last. But I can tell you on my last syndication, we actually were able to give a 15% preferred return. And the, what we're looking at for the, or the end play is around a 2.3 multiplier. So you're going to make about 2.3 times your investment. The reason why we can do that is because it's a business, because it's a flag. We look at areas like, for instance, that one that's in the business park, it's not doing that well now, but that area, just the land itself is going to be worth so many more millions of dollars just because of where it's at. So when you look at hotels, you look at two things, the land appreciation, but then because it's a flag, you look at that business appreciation.
And it could be that one or the other might be the more valuable exit strategy.
It is. It's like one of the hotels we have in a small town because so much is being built up around it. And this is, a hotel that's built in late 80s, I think, outside corridor. It's a nice hotel, but, there's a brand new grocery store, brand new, and 300 houses and bungalows. I mean, we have all this brand new stuff going up around it that someone's probably just going to come and say, here's $8 million, and they're just going to plow the hotel down and build some big thing. And the one next to the hotel that would be, or the hospital, that would be a great one. Someone to come in, say, we're going to do an assisted living, or we're going to do, just completely redo it and take the hotel away and do something else with it. So those are other plays that we can do. But that's what you have to look at. And, on my side, you're talking about some of the fees. On most of the commercial properties, unless you do a CMBS loan, which no one's going to do now, that's going to be my next play as far as buying are the ones that had the CMBS loans. I may have to personally guarantee the loan, like a $5 million, $6 million, $8 million loan. So I get a fee for managing that, just for taking that risk. We also get a fee for for managing all the investors. Okay. Now, a lot of those fees I go into like paying people, but those are some of the fees that we get. And then, you know, once the waterfall hits and you know, the preferred returns, then we split 80% to the investors, 20% to the ownership.
20% to the operator, and then maybe you as probably putting some cash in for the 80% too.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Because I, if I put in $500,000 into the hotel, then I get, you know, part of that 80%, then I get 20% just by being the owner. And then if I, then there's a waterfall, you know, you get like, if I happen to do 15% on top of what we've done, then it flips for that. That period, and then flips back, you know, so there's some waterfall structures in there. If I just really kick butt and so the investor would say, yeah, I'll give you the 80% first, you know, because you just made us a lot of money.
Gotcha.
So there's some other things in there that, and so not
like the deal by deal and the waterfalls probably get the prospectus and then look into it, but you're probably looking at a 15% preferred return. And then the 2.3 times the capital invested, does that 2.3 return, like I put $100,000 in and it was 15% for 5 years straight out of cash flow, and then we sell it and I'm getting $230,000 back, or would that also have counted in the 15% preferred return as well?
Right. Yeah, that's the total. That's the end. At the end of the 5 years or 7 years, you're going to make 2.3 times your money.
Altogether.
Okay. Altogether. And that's not including the, what that doesn't include is that 80-20. That's just cash. I mean, that's just money.
Got it. You know, there's still maybe a little extra if there's more profit on there, you're saying?
There's going to be, because you get the 15% preferred return, and that goes towards the 2.3. And then at the end, you're going to make sure that we get the 2.3. But then you get that
final distribution.
The distributions, you know, twice a year or whatever it is from the 80-20 split, and that's just slush.
Got it. That makes sense. So do you guys do renovations on every single room going in? Is there typically a repositioning on the front end? And what kind of a risk, or maybe dive deep a little bit on that renovation piece of the component time-wise? Is this a year long, year and a half? How does that work when you guys take a property over?
Yep, great question. So if we keep the property, let's say we keep it a Choice Hotel, we keep it a Quality Inn or a Comfort Inn, the franchise Choice is going to say they're going to go and inspect the property, and then they're going to give us what's called, which is in a hotel world, it's called a PIP. It's a kind of a performance improvement plan, and they're going to say, and we're going to know this prior to closing, they're going to say this needs to be done in order to get that hotel up to the Gen 4, Gen 5 quality standards. Okay. Because in the hotel world, every 5 years, every 7 years, they do a refresh. That's just kind of keeping all the hotels the same, all, you know, everything looking good, because Marriott and Hilton, all these, they have pride in their product, right? They don't need a rundown hotel with their flag, their name. So we're going to know what that is. And then we're going to have, because of our vendors, we're going to know, okay, this is going to cost us $500,000 to do this, or whatever it is. And then it's like going, okay, seller, guess what? I get a discount, because you can either do it, or if I have to do it, you're going to take it off. And it's just like the same thing if you're going to rehab a multifamily, right? And then that the flag is going to give us like 12 months in order to do all that sort of thing. You know, they're going to give us a time period. Some things maybe 24 months. Just depending on what it is. And then every couple of years, they're going to say, hey, you know, you have to change this, or you have to change the swimming pool chair, you know, just stuff. You know, I think people just have to keep their jobs, you know, so they come up with stuff that we have to replace, you know. And some of is really costly. It could be just the sign, you know, the big marquee sign.
$30,000-$40,000.
Oh, it's $60,000. And all they did is, instead of like a straight thing, they kind of made it a little little S. And
just it's a refresh.
Brand. It's a refresh. And I'm like, well, that refresh cost me $60,000 for that sign, plus all my stationery, plus every little, you got to change it. So it's like, you know, no one's ever going to notice that stuff, you know.
Gotta love it.
Gotta love it.
What are you able to stay open during that initial renovation? I mean, is construction going on while there's okay? So it's not all right, got it.
Yeah. What we do is whenever we do a PIP, even if it's a major one, like the one of the Radisson we had, they didn't even do any of the Gen 4 improvement plan. So what we did is okay, we're going to do the top floor. Everything left of the elevator, do that, you know, then we just move people around and then we come here. Then we, you know, it's kind of just, shuffling things around. Then we just go floor to floor, but oh yeah, you have to keep.
Yeah. You got to keep it open, right?
Got to keep it open. Yeah.
Is there any cost segregation or accelerated depreciation on the front end? Is that like part of the strategy year one?
Absolutely. Cost segregation is the way to do it. You know, one of the hotels, I'll tell you, it's, you know, I won't name the company unless you want me to, but you know, the guy's a big LinkedIn guy, big podcast guy too. And his cost segregation company saved, it was almost $1.2 million first year cost segregation.
Nice.
And we're like, and then all the investors on that first K1, they're like going, woo, you know.
So they put in 100 grand. What was the K1 loss, if you had to guess?
Oh, I don't know. It was, I don't know.
70-80% of the downturn?
Yeah, it was, I would say it was right at that. Yeah, so it was 1.2. Well, no, it was. Our absolute down payment on that one was $1.29 million.
Geez, like 97%, 100%.
It was like 97 almost, right? And it was almost one point two million was the cost segregation savings. And it takes them a long time. If none of you have ever gone through the cost segregation, my gosh, every stapler is, you know, amortized and depreciable. And so it's amazing. And especially when you have a business like a hotel, you know, it's a little, probably a little bit different than doing it in a multifamily, but you just have so much, every skillet, every waffle maker, I mean, and then we have, you know, how many beds, how many little mini refrigerators, how many toilet, I mean, it's like, it's just compounded out because we just have a lot of it, right?
So what about the exit strategy? Are you going in with a 5 to 7 year flip mentality? Is there a scenario where you would say, you know what, we got to refinance this thing and keep it. It's just too much of a cash machine. How do you make that decision? Is it a deal by deal or is it made later in the, maybe you could just speak to that a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. It is always a deal to deal. And you know, given economic circumstances, you know, when I do the syndications, I could do it within 5 years. Because if someone came up and said, you know, Mike, I'm going to give you $10 million for this property. I'm like, yeah, okay. Yep. Here we go. Or whatever it is. Most of them are 7. Because again, hotels are businesses. And when you have a business, it's not something I can just slap lipstick on, make it 100% occupancy, and then sell it. You know, you can't do that. You know, multifamily is maybe 3 year, 2 year, 3 year, something like that. With the business, now we have just a lot of economic type things and a lot of, we have comp sets. We have the business that we have to bring up and revenue that we need to bring up. So there's just a lot of strategies, a lot of time to bring a business up like that. So it's usually 7 year. But then if something like COVID happens, I have the ability to bring it up to like 10 years is the max. So on some of them that are just kind of took a hit, we may have to do a couple extra years. Most of them are, you know, will sell. But I have some investors that say, hey, Mike, you know, because one of the things that I have the opportunity to do is refi, pay off the investors, then I get it. You know, I could do that. I have that option. I could keep it and pay off the investors. But then I also have some investors that don't want any of that. They just want long term. So they'll say, Mike, I want to stay in it if you refinance it. So there's just all these different things that we could do. But generally, it's a 7 year, and then either cash out the investors, maybe keep a couple, but maybe refinance it. And you know, if I could refi and keep it under my portfolio, then I could do that.
Nice. So Mike, I know that from your profile and checking out on LinkedIn, you also have Gateway VAs and have leveraged virtual assistants. Would you double click on that topic for us here and how you've used them yourself and then maybe provide them for other people?
Yeah, and I can keep it quick. You know, for all of you people that are investors, at some point you're going to say, I'm working too much in my business instead of on it and growing it. You're paying the bills. You're doing all these things. And I got to that point and I was like going, you know, I'm not looking for my next multifamily. I'm not looking for my next deal. I'm too busy taking tenant calls and I'm doing all this sort of stuff. So what I did is I ended up getting a virtual assistant. And this virtual assistant happened to be out of Mexico, because I liked that because she was on my same time zone, college educated. But all of a sudden, it's like, going, wow, okay, I can give her all this work, all this stuff that allows me to stay on top, you know, the high level stuff. And then what happened was, and then I got another one, but then I was a panel expert at the seminar, and everyone was asking me, you know, at what point do you have employees? And I said, yeah, you know, I utilize virtual assistants, and it kind of went into it. I had a dozen people come up and say, hey, can I get a contact for this virtual assistant company? And I'm like going, guess what? Give me 2 days. LLC, operating agreement, da, 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 because we're entrepreneurs, right? I saw a need. And I contacted my virtual assistant and say, hey, do you know anyone just like you, college educated, wants to work real estate based, you know, can handle all this sort of stuff. And all of a sudden, bam, reached out to all those people, and Gateway Virtual Assistant Company was born out of their need. And it's fantastic. It's they'll do basically anything. You know, we can set them up with a VoIP phone, so they have an actual phone that has your area code in it. And they're one-on-one. It's not like a big company. They're one-on-one. It's basically like your employee. You know, we've had some VAs just them for, you know, 4 years. And it's really worked out well, and it's allowed us to really expand. And, you know, you can, there's a buy-in, you know, type of a 45-day trial period, but, you know, you're only paying them not very much money. But when you look at it for what they want, you can give them an upper middle class living, and it's basically half of what we would be paying, you know, an American worker. And we don't have any, you don't have any tax withholdings. You don't have any of the payroll tax, Social Security, Medicare. You don't have any of that. So it's a way to expand your business, and it has really saved us a lot of time and money.
Yeah, it's a really cool time that we live in where we can have worldwide talent. I mean, yeah, you know, you can get computer programmers, you can get website development, you can get people who speak very fluent English from Mexico or several other places around the world. I have several friends just like you who kind of put together very similar business models from Eastern European to the Philippines to Mexico. And it's really a cool time to be able to provide opportunity for people all the way around the globe. So, Mike, as we get to our wrap-up questions here, I'd like to ask you for the crown jewel of wisdom. And I would define that as what you would go back and tell yourself back in Indiana when you were buying that first property, what would you say?
The most important thing that I can tell any investor is don't do it alone. Okay. You need to do it, but in today's technology, in today's world, build a team and get a mentor. This is why you're listening to this podcast. This is why you're listening to this, and you know all the episodes that Dan has. Learn and ask questions, and learn from our mistakes so that you don't make them. That's what I would have done.
Yeah, you and I came up in the era before Google. I remember 2006, 2007. There was no Bigger Pockets. There was no podcast. Right. It was a very dark time to figure stuff out. And we are blessed to be at a completely different time where knowledge is so available, almost challengingly so. Mm-hmm. I would wonder, is there one book, you know, that you feel like made an impact, maybe besides Rich mm-hmm. Dad, Poor Dad, that you look back and say, you know what, this was one that was particularly useful for me, and it may not be the usual suspects, business or real estate related, but something of that nature.
Yeah. You know, another thing that I learned is once I started making money, I love to spend it. It's like, hey, you know, hey, I'm making, you know, I can do this, man. Look at me. There's this book, one of my mentors wrote it, and it's basically the money secrets of the rich, okay? And what you realize is the millionaires next door, why are they still in that house? Why are they still in, you know, these types of things? Why don't they have any debt? What's the kind of the difference? Because you can start making hundreds of thousands of dollars and still be as in debt as you were when you made $30,000. What can you do to transition yourself to where you have no debt? I'm talking about personal life. I mean, we're going to have asset debt, right? Well, what can we do to change or the way that we think that will get us actually to that next level, to where we actually build, you know, I have something that's on my office that I look at every morning, and it's a piece of paper that I wrote, build a life that you don't need a vacation from.
Nice.
And that's my mantra. Well, if I make $500,000 a year and I have $600,000 in debt, personal debt, I'm not building that vacation lifestyle because I'm still stressed. So that book will kind of teach you kind of the next step. It's not real estate based, but it's kind of that change in the mindset of how the rich kind of go about their lives. Not the pretend rich, but the actual rich. It's really good.
Do you have the title and author there if anyone wants to hunt it down?
Yeah, it's Money Secrets of the Rich by John Burley.
Good stuff. All right, Mike, how can listeners get more Mike Stoller, find out some information, potentially invest in one or more of your deals?
Sure. Look me up on LinkedIn. It's under Michael Stoller, S-T-O-H-L-E-R. Let me know that you found me through this podcast, and I'd love to answer any of the questions you have. Website's Gateway PE, as in private equity, gatewaype.com. And on there, you can look at some of the projects, what we do, and there's a tab up there for the virtual assistant pages.
All right, cool. Good stuff. Hey, Mike, I had a blast. I got several pages of notes. Great conversation on a very interesting and unique topic. Appreciate you coming on the show.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Take care, everyone.
Low-cost capital is the fuel of any volume real estate investment business. As a real estate investor, I am sure you're well aware of these two facts. First, your business is driven by access to capital, or starved from a lack thereof. And two, you make more money when you reduce the cost of said capital. Whether you're looking for hard money loans to fix and flip houses, rental portfolio loans, or even a line of credit, Lending Home offers the most competitive rates in the market, currently as low as 6.49%, which is good for fix and flip single family loans. I pay 10% myself at fundrehabdeals.com to my private investors. So at 6.49%, if you like that interest rate, go to reilineofcredit.com. Even if you're not currently in the market for a loan at this very minute, I encourage you to still go through that 1 minute sign up process right now so you can get on the email list. That way, once you're ready and you have a deal or a few, their name is top of mind. Plus, as a bonus for signing up through reilineofcredit.com, you'll receive a free iPad when you close your first loan. That's reilineofcredit.com. Thank you for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Remember to review the show and subscribe on your podcasting app. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe, which I think has been replaced by a little plus button icon on most podcasting apps lately. If you're interested in receiving my weekly Big Idea email, where I provide the most valuable jewel of wisdom that I discovered during the recording of the most recent episode, you can sign up for that email at reidiamonds.com. And at that site, you can also access the 204 episode archive broken down by category. Again, that's reidiamonds.com. So back in 2020, my house flipping business, Diamond Equity Investments, bought and sold 283 houses. And we're just about at the end of 2021 right now as I record this, and we've done 344 so far. We may have a couple more go through today. Mostly houses. A few were apartment buildings, and we currently have 142 other deals in our inventory, either under construction or under contract and awaiting closing. I just share those numbers so that you can kind of hear the growth, because I have three ways that you and I can do business. Number one, if you are interested in having access to real estate deals that you can buy, fix, and flip for profit, go to accessrealestatedeals.com. Number two, if you are an accredited investor who is seeking double-digit returns on your money passively, you can sign up to receive my private mortgage investment opportunity emails at fundrehabdeals.com. That is how you join my network of private lenders to potentially fund my projects. And number three, if you are interested in a fulfilling career with my company, Diamond Equity, the nation's premier real estate investment organization, I invite you to check out our open positions at careers.diamondequity.com. We have several openings available throughout the U.S., so if joining a winning team with high expectations and high earning potential sounds exciting to you, please go now to careers.diamondequity.com. We are at the conclusion, my friend. Next up, we have Gail and Hare joining us to discuss the nuance of buying property insurance and how to make a claim correctly in the event of a catastrophic loss. I like to call this a real estate investing topic for those of us who are actually buying, holding, buying, flipping properties and concerned with things like long-term risk. So this is a topic you will not want to miss. I'll catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.